Is it true that when you first undertook the project, the book, The Parting the Waters, you figured it would take only a few years to complete?
Well, the contract called for it to take 3 years to finish the whole book, and it was only supposed to be one book, and it wound up taking 24 years and stretching into three books. I knew it was a big undertaking. My previous book contracts were only for a year, so it was three times normal, but I had no idea what the eventual scope of it would be.
Your new book is a distilled version of the trilogy, Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. What led to this project? Why? And I don't know if condensed is the right word, but...
Yeah, condensed is not quite the right word, because I try not to change the storytelling language in the individual stories, but I do knit them together, and the painful part is selecting which ones I think are most salient. I took 18 of the stories out of the 2,300-page trilogy, kind of knitted them together a little bit, the ones I thought were most important for people in the digital age to know to get a full sweep of the civil rights era. And then I wrote new introductions for each of the 18 episodes to set the context for a new generation of readers.
How has your assessment or view of the civil rights movement changed since you first began what was to become the trilogy back in the early 80s? Or has it changed?
Well, over the course of doing the research for the trilogy and immersing myself in that history, I became ever more enthralled with how positive I think its effects have been on American history and far beyond race relations. Once people started struggling with what equal citizenship really meant, I think it yielded dividends in many aspects. It certainly changed the South that I grew up in, which was terrorized by race, and a lot of psychic energy was involved in maintaining segregation long ago. And millions of people, every breath they take is better than it was back then. So the longer I worked on it, the more I realized what a beneficial impact it has had. And at the same time, the sad part of it is that I think that we willfully misremember this era, that our historical memory of what the civil rights era did and didn't accomplish is still pretty distorted.
And why is that?
Well, I think people are uncomfortable with the period. It required many people to stretch beyond themselves and reach across boundaries and make acquaintances with new friends and accept new ideas and accept a larger version of view of what citizenship meant. And that's hard. It's hard in race relations, and people don't do it. So there was a lot of resentment. I think it's fair to say that once it was no longer respectable to endorse segregation in the South, it became very fashionable to cuss the government that forced the South to drop segregation. And it's been fashionable ever since to cuss the federal government as tyrannical. And I think that is in part a measure of how we're still uncomfortable with the history of the 1960s in today's politics. And in one respect, that's very sad. In another respect, it's not surprising, because we misremembered the Civil War for at least 100 years, thinking that it had nothing to do with slavery and that the Reconstruction period was a terrible trauma, and that the Ku Klux Klan were heroes. So we have a history of misremembering race relations in ways that do damage to our politics.
You grew up in Atlanta during the civil rights boycotts, the sit-ins, the demonstrations, the marches across the South. Atlanta avoided the violence that engulfed other Southern cities. Why do you think that was?
It did. Atlanta was a commercial center even then. There was a tremendous amount of effort to avoid it. There were some demonstrations, and believe me, having grown up in that period, there was a lot of anxiety. Anytime there was the slightest, and it didn't happen often, that there was the slightest racial mix in a public gathering, palms would get sweaty. People would fear that somebody wouldn't like it and that somebody would get in trouble. So there was a lot of racial tension, and there was a lot of anxious hoping that we would get through things peacefully because we were Atlanta. And in some senses, that's good. You know, Dr. King, his whole family, Daddy King, almost made him promise not to have demonstrations in Atlanta because the elite members of Black Atlanta felt that they had a unique form of progress and they didn't want to derail it. So there was controversy about that in Atlanta on both sides of the race line through the civil rights era.
Atlanta, you know, saw itself as the regional hub for the Southeast, but so did Birmingham at the time, and they were sort of in competition with one another, yet Birmingham's approach to civil rights demonstrations was completely different.
Yes, you know, my mother's from Birmingham, and I grew up in Atlanta, so I was well aware of the competition between the two cities and in some senses, civic Birmingham's resentment of Atlanta for getting kind of a head start. Part of that was because of the racial its racial image, that Atlanta was more progressive, whereas Birmingham was really caught in the steel city segregation image. I think more of it had to do with the commercial and industrial and transportation hub that Atlanta had going. But Birmingham was definitely the tipping point for civil rights in the United States. It's easy for people who didn't live through it to have no idea that most people in the United States knew that segregation was a problem, but really wanted it to be somebody else's problem. And there was an awful lot of passing the buck and doing everything people could to avoid it, until the spring of 1963, when Dr. King, in a supreme gamble, allowed even high school and smaller children to march in Birmingham into the teeth of police dogs and fire hoses in May of 1963. And those images of the dogs and fire hoses on orderly, marching, singing black teenagers and children really broke down people's psychological resistance to doing something in the civil rights movement, not only in Birmingham and around the United States, but even around the world. It really was a tipping point for political change in a very broad sense.
You've pointed out that the civil rights movement refined democracy. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I mean that American history has largely been about, what do we mean when we say we're all men are created equal? Does it include women? Does it include all adults? Does it include immigrants from overseas? Does it include slaves and ex-slaves? What do we mean by equal citizenship? And we have, our history has gradually refined it in the sense of broadening the sense of what equal citizenship means. And in that sense, the civil rights movement is unique in the sense that you had a black-led movement of people who had been largely excluded from the benefits of what democracy promised, who were actually taking leadership for the whole country and doing what Thomas Jefferson and George Washington had done, which was to confront systems that were hierarchical and that subjugated people, and converting them into a society of more equal citizenship. And in that sense, they were acting more or less like modern founding fathers and expanding the freedom that we enjoy in the United States.
Well, let me ask you about that. You know, it's been said that no one is indispensable to a movement, although, you know, many have said George Washington came close for his role in the Revolution and the early years of American democracy. Was Martin Luther King Jr. indispensable?
Well, he was an indispensable spokesperson in the sense that he had a great gift for putting the depth and the inspiration for the civil rights movement in the broadest possible terms that communicated to a wide audience. So I like to say he put one foot in the scriptures and the other foot in the Constitution, and was very sturdy in offering a view of the promise of equal citizenship to Americans. It's remarkable that he gave speeches about religion and politics every day, and had many enemies, but was never really criticized for mixing church and state because of the way he did it. He didn't try to subdue one with the other the way most people do. He basically invited you in and said, if you're concerned about equal votes, we have a movement for you. If you're concerned about equal souls before God, we have the same movement. And in that sense, he was an indispensable spokesperson, but the longer I worked on the movement, the more I realized how broad it was, and that it was a unique movement that involved millions of people, including young people, and that oftentimes they were ahead of Dr. King, and he knew it, and he said it. There are some times when human nature is so stubborn that an orator's words are not enough, and you have to have people willing to sacrifice and make witness, which is what college students and even high school students did in the sit-ins and Freedom Ride. So it was a very broad movement, led largely largely by females, quite frankly, except when there were microphones around. And in that era, the males still dominated the microphone, and Dr. King was the most prominent of those.
Well, yeah, I was going to ask you, to what extent did King's role in his martyrdom, you know, overshadow other leaders and activists within the movement? Bob Moses, for example, you point out in the book, played a key role. And yet most people who have a general familiarity with the civil rights movement, you know, don't know who these people were.
Well, again, that's part of our faulty memory across the racial lines. It takes people in the United States who tend to be divided and comfortable with their own groups. History shows that it takes us a long time, even after we make progress, as in the Civil War and in the Civil Rights Movement, to become comfortable with the progress that we've made. You know, I think you could argue that even about Barack Obama today. We have an African-American president for the first time, and it is unmistakably a sign of comfort and progress that that's even a possibility in the United States. And yet we hardly discuss race issues, in part because we're still nervous about having an African-American president. He doesn't discuss race issues very much. He goes out of his way to reassure people that he's not a racially based president. So as important as the dividing, you know, getting along across the lines that divide us, and race is, of course, is by no means the only one, as important as those things are, we're still a little nervous about them. We're not as comfortable talking about race as we are about sports.
Many of the lions of the movement have passed on, or they're well on in years now. Where is the movement today, or is it even accurate to use the term movement anymore?
Not in the sense of a central change in history that is growing and consuming large numbers of people. I'm sad to say that the watchword for American politics today is more spin than movement, and there couldn't be a greater contrast. Movement is something that starts when an individual is quietly moved, and it grows into something that is shared with large numbers of people who discover that they, you know, have beliefs in common, and they're enlarged by that, and you can literally change history with a movement, whereas spin kind of assumes that there's really no purpose to it other than entertainment, and that the spin means there's no inherent value in it. We're just spinning politics for our entertainment. We don't have that sort of transcendent movement going on now, but there are an awful lot of people in the United States, in public interest groups and in social movements and non-governmental organizations that are trying to live up to the promise that was left in the civil rights movement. And so there are an awful lot of people quietly percolating along trying to do good works, but the dominant spirit of the time still hasn't come to terms with the civil rights era.
Solid South, still pretty solid. You know, many of the white Democrats are now Republican. How long do you think that will last? Census projections show that Texas, Florida, Georgia even, will in a few years become minority-majority.
Yes, and they will have to adapt to that. I mean, one of the chapters in this distilled book, I put together what in the trilogy are two different chapters about the presidential conventions in 1964, the Democratic and Republican. I put them together to show how powerful a race is, no matter what we say or try to convince ourselves that it doesn't matter. In 1964, in one single year, the South went from almost exclusively Democratic, the party of segregation, where there wasn't a single Republican congressman between the Atlantic Ocean and the far reaches of Texas, not one. And of course, when I grew up, there were scarcely any Republicans in the South. Republicans were Yankees. They were eccentric judges who believed in the two-party system. Everybody was a Democrat because the Democrats were the party of segregation. And that lasted until Lyndon Johnson pushed through the Civil Rights Act in 1964, and he was a Democrat. And at the Republican convention in San Francisco, the Republican nominee, Barry Goldwater, announced that he was going to vote against the Civil Rights Bill. And all of a sudden, people sprang up in the South saying, I want to be a Republican, even though until then, Republicans had been the party of Lincoln. History did a very rare U-turn then and turned from solid South Democratic segregationists into rising Southern Republicans resenting the federal government and Southern Democrats nervously trying to knit together cross-racial coalitions for the first time. So And to a large degree, we still have that development going, but we have all sorts of other demographic changes going on that really cloud the partisan picture of politics. But there's no question that in 1964, the subliminal power of race in politics turned the whole structure of national politics inside out.
Taylor Branch is the author of The King Years, Historic Moments in the Civil Rights Movement. Mr. Branch will be speaking at the Atlanta History Center on Tuesday night, January 22nd. Mr. Branch, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Enjoyed talking with you.